Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. The most wonderful time of the year can also be one marked by depression. For some, this is just a momentary mood swing, but others can be suffering from something called seasonal affective disorder, which, according to Johns Hopkins, is a depression that sets in during a particular time of year, most often in fall and winter. They haven't yet pinpointed its cause, but many believe the shorter days with less light that set in during this time of year are a contributor. It just so happens that this time of limited daylight also coincides with holidays that aren't equally merry for everyone. Some are not celebrating or in a mood to celebrate. Many are lonely and alone. Others associate this time of year with loss and disconnection from family and loved ones. And those feelings are set against the backdrop of others enjoying festivities. That and social media can exacerbate the sadness many feel at this time of year. So is there help for these folks? We delve into that this hour with Dr. Jeremy Nobel, lecturer on global health and social medicine at Harvard Medical Center and founder and president of the Foundation for Art and Healing. Dr. Nobel is also author of Project Unlonely, Healing Our Crisis of Disconnection. And welcome to the program. Thank you for being here.
It's an absolute pleasure, Mike.
And Dr. Hannah Hoffman is assistant professor of animal science in the College of Agriculture and Natural Resources at Michigan State University, whose research is focused on understanding how disruptions in our natural circadian rhythms can increase a number of disorders and affect our behavior. Dr. Hoffman, thank you for being here too. Welcome.
Thank you so much.
I'm going to begin with you, Dr. Nobel. According to the University of Utah, up to 20% of Americans experience what we call seasonal depression disorder, or the milder subsyndromal, if that's the word, syndromal season affective disorder, also known as the winter or holiday blues. First, do you agree with that percentage, 20%? And second, how do you determine if someone is simply sad or depressed or lonely because they aren't surrounded by loved ones at holiday time, or whether they're suffering from one of these more serious disorders?
Well, Mike, first, let me thank you and the station for addressing attention on this topic. You know, the holidays can be, exactly as you said, a very festive, enjoyable time for many, but for others, less so. And I think what you just described, a combination of effects, whether it's depression, seasonal affective disorder, loneliness, or other kinds of factors, can also combine in ways that kind of gang up on people. So I'll turn to Dr. Hoffman to talk more about seasonal affective disorder. That's not my area of focus. But what I will say about loneliness is it's very common during the holiday times. And it's something that we can learn to recognize, navigate, and get through. And hopefully we'll have a chance to talk not just about what loneliness is, but why the holidays increase the risk for it, but then most importantly, what we can do about it.
Okay, and we will. I hope. I don't think we'll run out of time before we get to that. So, Dr. Hoffman, I know that you think that the number of people suffering from this is higher than the 20% I quoted a moment ago. I think you've said it is as high as 40%. And tends to rise the farther from the equator you get. So clearly this is based on sunshine and sunlight, because you are further north in Michigan than we are here in North Carolina. So is that to say there are more people in Michigan that will suffer from this than those of us here?
Yes, exactly. I always think about it as like the equator to pole effect. So the closer you are to equator, because the day length doesn't change as much, or it doesn't change at all, right? The closer you are to equator, the more sunlight, high quality sunlight, because we also need to talk about the quality of the light, the less likely you are to see this kind of seasonal depression, especially the one we observe in the winter. So the further north you go, the more frequently people are diagnosed with seasonal affective disorder. So down, for example, in the South, around like Florida, for example, it's maybe 1-3% who suffer from seasonal depression or who are diagnosed, right? Because it's one thing suffering, another thing is actually being diagnosed. Whereas I'm in Michigan, it's probably around 20. Northern Michigan, it might even be more. And another important thing to remember is that we're not, you know, there's an age aspect here, but there's also what we can consider a sex difference, where more women, actually 4 times more women, are diagnosed with seasonal depression than men.
That was going to be my next question. Do we understand why?
We do not understand why. We do not know why more women are diagnosed. There's a couple of, you know, behavioral differences between men and women in general, where women in general, not all of them, or not everyone, right, are more likely to seek out help, and that helps with diagnosis. Whereas men, not everyone again, but men are typically less likely to be diagnosed. So I don't think the real difference is a fourfold difference, but there's a fourfold difference in how many are diagnosed.
And
but there is
a
certain sex difference, yeah.
And how do we know it's more light-related than anything else, given the fact that the further north you go, at least in this hemisphere, the colder it gets, and so you're indoors and you're bundled up, and it's probably cloudier than normal because those parts of the country are under snow alerts constantly, at least that's our impression. How do we know it is light-related as opposed to all the other factors that come with winter?
Because 80% of individuals diagnosed with seasonal depression can be effectively treated with light. So we know light therapy is effective in 8 out of 10 individuals who are diagnosed. And because light therapy can treat it, and the association with the shorter days, which of course come with lower temperatures, are both associated with seasonal depression. The fact that we can treat it and reverse it with light is a very good indicator supporting our current hypothesis that seasonal depression for most people is caused by the lack of high quality bright sunlight in the winter.
So let's talk about the symptoms so people will know if they're suffering from this at all, or maybe it's something else. What are the symptoms of this so-called seasonal affective disorder?
So the symptoms, they really go on a scale, and we all, I say we because I personally suffer from seasonal depression and I'm now treating myself, so it's not impacting my life as much anymore. But the symptoms, they start usually with feeling like more sluggish. You lose interest in activities you typically like. Many people will experience problems sleeping. You will have difficulty concentrating, you will have feelings of hopelessness, worthless, you feel guilty. And what makes a big difference between just having like a bad day and depression is that you feel this most of the day, most of the days of the week. So it's really something that is persistent for a long time, where everyone can have a bad day, right? But when you're depressed, it's almost all the time. And when it really become serious, sorry, that's when you start to think about death or talk about wanting to commit suicide. You're really serious here.
But what's the difference between the depression you may feel because of seasonal affective disorder and clinical depression, where you are depressed most of the time?
It's the same. So it's the same symptoms. The difference is that seasonal depression goes away for the majority of the people when day length gets longer and light quality goes up. That's why there's a seasonal aspect to it. But the depression is the same. It's the same experience for the individual. It's the same, mostly the same changes in the brain. And the difference is just that seasonal depression is not all year, but it's the same symptoms and it's the same experience.
So if this is being caused by changes in daylight, what you call quality daylight, and the amount of that quality daylight that we get, what's going on chemically in our brains that lead us to this depressed state?
Well, if we just knew all of it, that would be amazing. So we do know some, again, because we have a shared changes in the brain with depression, which is very well studied. for seasonal depression, what happens is that light, especially very bright light, in the summer, bright light can be as much as 100,000 lux. The lux is the measure we measure light in. And like in where I'm sitting right now, we probably have 300 lux. So indoor lighting is around 300. So you can compare that to 100,000. Even on a bright day in the winter with snow, you reach 100,000 lux. So that's what I call the intensity of light. So this really bright light are captured by your eyes and is transmitted to the brain through your optic nerve. And this very bright light is activating. So what happens is that when you get this light signal into the brain, it actually promotes the brain to wake up, okay? One of these wake up signals is a neurotransmitter called serotonin. This is why the symptoms are the same as the, you know, regular depression, because when you have seasonal depression, you also have lower serotonin levels. Thus, one treatment for seasonal depression is, you know, some of the drugs that are used to treat depression. Now, the difference with seasonal depression is that because it's most likely caused primarily by light, we can also, you know, mimic and trick the brain to think it's summer by using light therapy. So you can use these light therapy boxes in the morning, and you can actually trick the brain to think it's a bright sunny morning using light therapy. And if you use it for a while, this can actually help you correct this lack of, you know, feeling good wellness neurotransmitters in the brain.
As I understand it, you're the expert here, but it's not just the amount of light or the brightness of the light. It's actually the color of the light. And most people don't think much about light having color. It's bright or it's not. But anybody who's bought an LED light bulb knows that there are different colors of light. So what is the impact of the color of the light on this syndrome?
Yes. So, I mean, natural, I always think about the more we can mimic natural sunlight, the better, right? So natural sunlight appears white, but it's actually all colors of the rainbow. So each color actually has a different energy level. So when you want to go for what is really promoting a mood and wellness, we need to look at the blue and green wavelengths. So the blue and green are high energy. They will allow the brain to really know it's morning. Whereas when you go to orange and red, it's more calming. So this is something people can actually use at home. You mentioned LED lights. Most LED lamps, now you can get all kinds of them, but if you don't look for the special ones, they are very much blue light enriched. They're not going to treat seasonal depression because they're not bright enough, but they will help you wake up. Now, using a lot of LED light in the evening will actually make it hard for you to sleep. So you have to learn to use light light bulbs in an intelligent manner by using bright lights in the morning. And then in the evening, you can use more orange or red shifted light bulbs. And today with the LED light bulbs, you can buy them and it will say that they are dim or they are orange or yellow. And if you use these type of light bulbs in the evening, again, mimicking sunset, it will help you promote the release of this hormone called melatonin. Melatonin helps you sleep. And again, one of the symptoms of seasonal depression or depression is a lack of sleep. So again, the more you can try to heal and hit many different aspects of the symptoms, right, if you can sleep, you will also start to heal, which I'm sure Dr. Noble can talk about, the value of sleep and well-being, but using light intelligence can definitely help overcome.
Dr. Hanna Hoffman is an assistant professor of animal science at Michigan State University. When we come back, we're going to talk about loneliness. It's the other side of this holiday coin and what impact that has on you with Dr. Jeremy Nobel from Harvard University. Stay with us at Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, using Mazda's customer-centric approach to cars to create a car buying and servicing experience where the customer is the center of their business. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and WFAE.org. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about some of the downsides of the holiday season, the fact that this holiday in the Northern Hemisphere occurs in the darkest days of winter, which can bring on, for some, seasonal affective disorder, which we have been talking about with Dr. Hannah Hoffman, assistant professor of animal science at Michigan State University. But the Honnellys are supposed to be merry and bright and filled with family and friends, and not everybody has access to that subset of individuals. And we're going to talk about loneliness and the impact of that with Dr. Jeremy Nobel, lecturer in global health and social medicine at Harvard University Medical Center and the author of Project Unlonely, Healing Our Crisis of Disconnection. We were just talking, as you know, Dr. Nobel, about this light situation and low light levels causing depression, the seasonal affective disorder. I'm just curious, before we talk about loneliness, can the depression of loneliness at the holidays or any other time of year be exacerbated by seasonal affective disorder? In other words, can you have both situations affecting you at the same time?
I think there's no question it can. I mean, depression, as we understand it, an experience of deep and persistent sadness, has certain markers in the brain neurophysiologically. And Hannah mentioned some of these, you know, kind of reduction in serotonin, but there are other neurotransmitters involved too. So that, you know, we can almost think about depression as the final state. The interesting question is what leads to that level of depression. And depression often changes our behaviors in ways that could then make us even more depressed, or let's look at the upside, less depressed. And understanding that interplay of how we feel and then also how we act and how we changes in our actions can change how we feel is really the strategy of navigating difficult times like the holidays.
Let's be clear about something here. When we talk about loneliness, everybody is alone at some point in their days or in their lives or maybe for long periods of time, but they're not necessarily lonely. But then there are people who are surrounded by others and they are lonely. Talk about the difference between being alone and being lonely.
So there's a critical difference, Mike, and I think loneliness literacy is one of the important things called for in the Surgeon General's recent report, an advisory, Health and Human Services, on loneliness as a major public health crisis that just came out in May. Being alone is an objective state. It's a lack of social connection with others. Being lonely is subjective. It's a feeling. It's a mood. It's the gap between the social connections we want to have, that we aspire to have, sometimes that we dream about, Mike, and what we feel we do have. And that gap, that loneliness, can have significant mental health and physical health consequences, which is why the increase in loneliness has become viewed as a public health crisis.
One study that I saw yesterday indicates that about 58% of Americans are lonely. That number seems high to me. Is it?
So it's important to understand that there are different types of loneliness and that you can interact with those types in different ways. And the holidays are a great example. There are at least two very different types of loneliness you can experience in the holidays. One is if you don't have a party to go to. No one's invited you. You don't have the social contacts. As you say, you're just watching all these advertisements talk about and kind of emphasizing that successful holidays, they're always, you're surrounded by lots of people, family and friends, but you don't have that access to that. So that's a kind of loneliness you don't have, or you're experiencing that gap. But there's another kind of loneliness, which is you go to the holiday party and you feel you have nothing to say to the people around you. This is being lonely in a crowd. That's also a common kind of loneliness that many people are experiencing. So how do we make sense of these different types of loneliness? And at the heart of it is understanding that loneliness requires a connection, not just to other people, but to yourself. And the holidays are an interesting and challenging time for that. If we're distracted because we feel there's something wrong with us, that we don't have family and friends and connections the way the media promotes them. But it also can be a time of great exploration of who you are, what matters to you, exploring feelings of gratitude, of renewal, in ways that could then increase your sense of connection to yourself, to the bigger human narrative, to a sense of possibilities, and make you optimistic and push back against some of the dark feelings of low self-esteem or lack of self-worth that burden many people during the holidays.
Both of these states of loneliness that you talked about a second ago, being lonely in a crowd, being lonely because you are at home alone while everybody is out partying and holiday times, I'm wondering if it's deeper, more persistent, more damaging to you if it happens at holiday time. Because let's face it, we are being inundated at holiday time with messages that tell us we have to be happy. We're supposed to be happy. We're supposed to have a house filled with grandma and grandpa and the kids running around and people coming to the door caroling. We hear it in our songs. We hear it. We watch it on television and holiday movies and TV shows. It's just expected that this is what happens. And you are not experiencing that for whatever reason. So is that making things worse, deeper, more damaging?
There's no question in my mind that it is making things worse. I think, as Hannah pointed out, our brains are very sensitive to external stimuli. Her work is around light as an external stimuli, but media is another type of external stimuli that our brains process. And that processing converts all those well-intentioned advertisements and so on, you know, or even social activities around you in your community into an interpretation that there's something wrong with us, that we're inadequate. Those feelings start triggering a cascade of brain responses also and deepen the sense of depression or anxiety or lack of self-worth that then can lead to addiction, to self-harm, to suicidality. So it's not just a bad mood. Being lonely can kill you. And it's not just through mental health. It increases risk of heart attack or stroke or death from either by 30%, increases risk of dementia by 40%, type 2 diabetes by 50%. So loneliness won't just make you miserable. It can kill you, but it doesn't have to. And wow, that's really the important message to the audience.
So Dr. Hoffman, the depression that one may feel because they are lonely at holiday time or any time of the year, chemically in the body, is it the same thing that we're experiencing with the depression that we may feel because of less daylight or less exposure to light, the seasonal affective depression?
I mean, in my opinion, and Jeremy Noble can follow up here, we know the circuits are the pathways in the brain that are promoting mood. And these include, we talked about serotonin. There's another one called dopamine, for example. So it's not just one mechanism that can change how you are feeling. So are these shared with loneliness? I'm pretty sure they are. But I will let Jeremy answer this question. But I think they are.
Okay.
Well, let me follow up on that maybe, Mike. I think there's no question that this interplay of what we experience in the world, how we process that, then turns into a neurophysiologic cascade that changes how we behave. And those behaviors then either allow us to get closer to people and experience a sense of connection, or if they push us the other way, to increase the sense of isolation and loneliness and make things worse. And what's often we're not aware of is that we can control some of that by how we behave, by our curiosity, by what we do with our time and how we strive to connect in some very specific ways.
Dr. Hoffman.
Yeah, I wanted to follow up on that because I think it's really important that the power each person have to actually, once you recognize, right, it's all about recognizing that you are lonely or that you are, you know, getting depressed or you are depressed. And sometimes you actually need your environment or the people around you to tell you because you might not recognize it yourself. But you do have power. And for example, for seasonal depression, one of the effective treatments is talking therapy and cognitive behavioral therapy, where you talk about strategies you can implement to change your behavior. And again, when you change your behavior, for example, setting up a date to say, I'm going to speak with this person, I'm going to go for a walk, whatever it is that gives you joy, well, your changes in behavior will again impact your brain. So it's really this dual connection between, but what I study, as you said, I study how light can diminish the feeling of well-being by changing the neurochemical pathways in your brain. But you can be proactive. You can change your behavior. You can use light therapy. Some people might need medication And that's okay, right? It's you don't seek out to be sad. So there's all these tools we can use to kind of get the brain back up to a level where you enjoy life again.
You mentioned, Dr. Hoffman, that women are diagnosed more frequently with seasonal affective disorder than men, and that could be because men don't seek help and therefore go undiagnosed. But I also believe that this is something that is rarely suffered by those under 20 years of age. Why?
It's really, yes, that's true. I mean, there is a lot of research showing, especially with women around menopause. So changes in your sex steroids can change, you know, your mood and how your brain works. That's very well recognized. So seasonal depression, there's no age for developing it. And again, if you have really good strategies, you might not have it 1 year and you might experience it another year. So they can be like accumulating changes in your environment or your behavior that causes it or makes it happen. But yes, most individuals are diagnosed in their late teens or early 20s. It's rare that it's diagnosed down in the elementary age. That said, some children are diagnosed down to 6, 7 years of age. It's rare, but it can happen. Again, some people don't have seasonal depression until later in life. So there's not an age. And you don't need to experience it. Or like, usually, you know, you will experience it year after year. But for example, I used to live in California and I didn't have seasonal depression. I moved to Michigan and the first year I knew I was going to develop it. And it still kind of sneaked up on me. It was my husband who told me, he's like, you're laying in bed all day. And I study it. I know. And it still comes so gradually that I myself did not recognize it. Huh. And that's why it's so important to listen to people around you, and like they will have a good feeling or judgment about if you change. And you might not. I did not recognize the change in myself. It was my environment who told me.
Dr. Nobel, is there a similarity here? In other words, when it comes to loneliness, is one age group, one gender more susceptible than another, or does it affect everybody relatively equally?
Well, Mike, it surprised a lot of people when studies were done in 2018 and 2019 showing the loneliest adult demographic is not older adults, which everyone thought, but 18 to 24. So there is a lot of very specific susceptibility to loneliness in certain demographic groups. Because if we're already marginalized for other reasons, right? So because of low income, race, gender, illness, aging, then there's an increased risk that you will be removed from the exact social engagement and social activity that energizes, that stimulates our brain, that changes our behavior, and makes us feel more connected. So this newer awareness of how intersectional different risks for loneliness, for depression and the consequences of loneliness are, really invites us to take a much more integrated view on how we think about our social engagement, not just with other people, but how we make sense of our own inner selves and our moods and thoughts, for instance, during the holidays. Build on the very strong tradition of meaning of the holidays. Even if you don't have parties to go to, you can investigate that on your own in some very simple ways by going through family photo albums and recalling the wonderful times you've had, even if people may have passed away. Sometimes people enjoy expressive writing to try to describe their thoughts and feelings in ways that allow them to re-experience that sense of closeness and connection. So there are many things we can do to reshape our brain's ability to connect with our environment in ways that make us healthy and well.
And I asked why, if you thought one age group or one gender was more susceptible to this, because we've done other programs in which it was discussed that men are probably lonelier than women because they are more closed. They don't develop the social networks of friends and support groups that women have because they're more open to sharing things about their lives than men are. Does that hold water here in this discussion, Dr. Nobel?
You know, there's a lot of interesting discussion about whether men or women are more susceptible to loneliness, and it's been hard to demonstrate in any consistent way. Now, part of that is because, as we talked about, being lonely is subjective. And if there's a stigma that surrounds it and men won't say they're lonely, it's very hard to measure. Now, we do know that both men and women do experience not just loneliness, but the things that the consequences of loneliness, the mental and physical consequences, but the strategies of being less lonely may be different for men and women, and we need to understand those and promote them. So in the same way that Hannah talked about the external stimulus of light being so helpful for depression, one of the things that my research has indicated is that creative arts, creative expression, can be a tremendous external positive stimulus to our brains to make us feel more engaged and less lonely. And it does that in three ways. So the first is, and this is well studied, that the arts change the neurophysiologic outputs of our brain. So cortisol, the stress hormone, is reduced, not just in making art, but in beholding art, in listening to music, in looking at visual art. So cortisol, the stress hormone, goes down, and the so-called feel-good hormones, so dopamine, serotonin, oxytocin, endorphins, go up. So at the very least, engaging with creative arts makes us more relaxed and in a good mood. That's a great way to connect with people right there.
How much of it has to do with the
more than that?
Go ahead. I'm sorry.
Finish. No, please go ahead, Mike.
I was going to ask, a lot of what you're talking about, particularly performing arts, if you go see the ballet or you go see a Broadway show or you go see anything that's on a stage, you might be entertained, and there's entertainment value in that, and that may help what we're talking about today. So more people allegedly go to arts performances than go to football, but sports gets all of the hoopla in America. So is it the same? If you get entertainment value from watching a basketball or a football game, does it have the same effect on you that the arts would have on you?
I think it can, actually, but it's not the entertainment value of either sports or the arts that connects people. It's the sense that it's a shared experience. That, you know, when you watch a football game, there was a lot of it on just this last holiday weekend, you feel like you're participating with the crowd. You hear the roar, the applause, and so on. So it's not just the experience, it's how we make sense of it in the context of social connection.
Dr. Jeremy Nobel is the author of Project Unlonely, Healing Our Crisis of Disconnection, and it turns out that crisis is not hyperbole, and we'll talk about that and more when we come back. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, incorporating Mazda's customer-centric vehicle design by making the customer the center of business to create a better car buying experience. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about seasonal affective disorder and also about loneliness, both at holiday times and the impact that they have on your mental health and on your physical health, with Dr. Hannah Hoffman, who's an assistant professor of animal science at Michigan State University and an expert on light and how it impacts the chemical processes in your brains that can lead to your moods, and Dr. Jeremy Nobel, a lecturer on global health and social medicine at Harvard Medical Center and the founder and president of the Foundation for Art and Healing. His book is called Project Unlonely. It's subtitled Healing Our Crisis of Disconnection, and it turns out that crisis is not hyperbole. The UK's National Library of Medicine calls loneliness, quote, a major contemporary public health concern in the UK and other developed Western countries. And this is a problem not only because of its pervasiveness, but because there are negative impacts. The loneliness, you said a moment ago, Dr. Nobel, that this can kill you. This is not just being sad and lonely and, oh, woe is me. This can kill you. How long have we known that?
Well, the idea that loneliness causes this classic triad of mental health concerns, depression, addiction, and suicide, this has been well known for maybe 30 plus years. the growing understanding of loneliness on physical illness and the harm of loneliness on increasing the risk of dying early, premature mortality, that's been known for about 15 or 20 years, but we've gotten much more precise about that measurement. And so this, I think, has really ignited people's concern about loneliness, particularly since the pandemic has, while it was challenging in many ways, one positive aspect of the pandemic is it's allowed us to talk about loneliness because so many of us experienced it. So we're having now conversations about loneliness in ways that we didn't when I first started doing research and activity in public health and loneliness 10 years ago. And that's a tremendous step forward, but there's still a long way to go.
So the pandemic didn't reveal possibly anything we didn't know, particularly medical experts didn't know, but it gave us all a common experience that we now understand what it feels like for everybody who goes through this. Is that what you're saying?
I think that's right. So it's given us a sense that isolation, which is what happened during the pandemic, we isolated in order to reduce the risk of viral spread, also made us lonely. So being isolated is different from being alone, but they do relate to each other. So if you're not around other people because you're isolated, very often that does increase your sense that you don't have the social connections you want.
Right.
But being isolated isn't stigmatized in our culture, but being lonely is, because we're almost culturally trained to think that if I'm lonely, it's my fault. There's something wrong with me. I'm inadequate. I'm flawed. What the pandemic did is it gave people an experience of loneliness that wasn't tied to that negative self-assessment. We were lonely during the pandemic in a way because we were all working together to fight a common enemy, the virus. And so we could talk about loneliness in ways that we hadn't been able to do before. And that has been so helpful to reset our kind of social tolerance and our social willingness to actually face loneliness as one of the human experiences we all have.
So
it is
doctor,
one of the most human experiences to feel the need for other people. You can even imagine that goes back to prehistoric times when if you didn't have other people around that you trusted and connected with, it was a real risk to just immediate survival from saber-toothed tigers and other kind of things. So of course, now, no saber-toothed tigers around, but there's still many situations where everyone feels safer, more connected, and able to lead good lives if they have trusted, friendly relationships with other people. And that is what we aspire to.
So Dr. Huffman, Dr. Nobel has said that loneliness can kill you because of the physical effects on you as a result of depression, and loneliness can make you feel inadequate. As you spoke about seasonal affective disorder, it's pernicious in that it can sneak up on you and you, the sufferer, do not recognize it. Can it too kill you? I mean, aside from people being so depressed that they will take their own lives, can it too kill you because of the physical impact of that depression? Or is it so short-lived that you're going to get over that when the sun comes out in April?
So, I mean, it's all about risk factors, right? So, yes, you can commit suicide, unfortunately, and, you know, this program is wonderful in that sense that we bring in more awareness to it and have people talk about it, because talking about what we experience is really important so that you can, you know, use your network. Now, with seasonal depression, again, it's a season. It depends on where you live, how early it's going to start. Again, the further north, the earlier in the year, probably. And it also depends on who you are. We're not equally sensitive or responsive to light. There's a lot of variation, which is why not everyone develops seasonal depression. Now, when you are depressed, you have all these changes in behavior and physiology, right? People will change their eating habits. You either overeat or you undereat. You might stop exercising. You are more likely to have poor food choices, such as high rewarding foods. And we know that these type of life choices increases the risk of cardiovascular disease, of obesity. So yes, will it kill you? Probably not year one, right? But if you have a long-lasting seasonal depression year after year, it will definitely increase your risk of long-term health effects on on your body, which might kill you after, you know, years.
What you just said goes back to what you said about your husband noticing that you had the seasonal affective disorder because you were staying in bed longer than normal. And it seems to me that that kind of depression, and maybe all forms of depression, lead you to making unwise decisions about your own behavior that that make things worse. You're doing the exactly wrong things. You're self-medicating with the exact wrong things that end up making you feel worse, not better. How do we recognize that?
Yeah, that's a really good summary of it. So it's really, you really bit by bit degrade yourself, and it's this downward spiral, and it's very difficult to get out of on your own. So that's where your environment is very important in. When there's a big change in your behavior, if you recognize a big change in the behavior of someone you know, speak with them about what might be driving this. Jeremy?
I'm so glad you used the word spiral, because I think that's what's underappreciated in a lot of mood disorders in general, and certainly around loneliness, and possibly around seasonal affective disorder also. So what do I mean by a spiral? A spiral in loneliness is when you feel lonely and then you feel low self-esteem or there's something wrong with you. So you start avoiding social connection. As a result, you feel lonelier, you feel worse about yourself, and you're even more avoidant. So that's a spiral. And to your point, Hannah, about other things you do to distract yourself from the discomfort, overeating, too much alcohol intake, other kind of behaviors, that increases the acceleration of the spiral too. So what I'm very interested in both my research and the book that Mike mentioned, Project on Lonely, Healing Our Crisis of Disconnection, has a central theme that really is, how do we reverse the spiral? Are there ways we can, instead of going in the negative, self-destructive way, start going in a positive, hopeful, optimistic way? And what I focus on in my book is the very compelling research showing that creative arts, poetry, music, dance, visual arts, either making it or experiencing it, particularly when you do it and share it with other people, can actually reverse the negative spiral. And my interesting question, now maybe a clinical trial we can do together, Dr. Hoffman, is you have one group of people with seasonal affective disorder who get typical therapy, including the light box. For another intervention arm, in addition, they also get some creative expression therapy, where we invite them really specifically not just to generally do the arts, but to express their experience with seasonal affective disorder, to write a poem about it, to do a collage about how it feels, and to share that in a group interactive experience, which I do talk about that kind of model in my book, because we've been doing it for 10 years, and see if a combination of being creatively curious, making things, a poem, a collage, and so on, and then sharing it actually has a positive impact. I'm quite confident it will. And I'd love to demonstrate that with you.
Go ahead, Dr. Hoffman.
Yeah, I have a really interesting follow-up question here, because if you have someone who is already being creative and expressing themselves through, paintings or writing, is this a way that you, if it's someone in your family, where you might be able to kind of identify that these individuals might be lonely, and this is something that everyone can use to start the conversation with this individual, looking at their expression, whatever, way it might be?
Absolutely. And again, as a public health practitioner, so although, I'm an internal medicine physician, a lot of my work is how do you take this knowledge, including the knowledge, Dr. Hoffman, that you have on seasonal affective disorder, and put it to work in our communities so that we don't have to be burdened by it. And very simple interventions, like encouraging people to take a photograph that captures their mood, for instance, about seasonal affective disorder, and share it on their webpage or in their Instagram feed. This is how we externalize who we are to other people, tell our story. And I think storytelling is a public health intervention. Much the same way we can intervene in other ways.
I don't want to run out of time before we talk about some of the get into the nitty gritty of some of the therapies for both of these situations, loneliness and seasonal affective disorder. But I'd like to hear from both of you about what we were just talking about a little bit more, because It seems to me that if you are suffering from these things, or if you're depressed for any reason, the inertia that you suffer makes it very difficult to take the steps that you're talking about, whether it's like getting light therapy or other kinds of therapy for seasonal affective disorder, or reversing the effects of loneliness by being among people, by being a creator, or by experiencing the creative arts process. Can that come from within, or do you need a third party to say, hey, come on, let's do this, come on? Do you need somebody to help you?
I don't think you need them, Mike, but it helps. We all need a little nudge, positive encouragement, someone who cares about us, maybe saying, why don't you try this? Now we can find it on our own, but that's why, again, holidays coming up, shameless promotion for my book, buy this book for someone you think might benefit from sharing who they are with other people. That's at the heart of the message of be curious, make things, have conversations. And it's not complicated. It's not the quality of the art. You don't have to be Picasso. Just get your thoughts and feelings down on a page. It'll change your enthusiasm for doing more of it. The arts do four things brilliantly well. I think we just know this from personal experience. First of all, they engage our attention. So you're not thinking about the 200 emails that you're behind on. You're totally in the moment. The second is the arts inspire us. That's a very particular kind of motivation. But it's not just the motivation to like clean your closet. It inspires us to do bigger, important, meaningful things. So in the holidays, that's particularly relevant. The third things the arts do is they empower us. They not only inspire us to think about what's possible, they give us the belief we can achieve that, a sense of agency and possibility. It's very exciting. And then the fourth thing is they connect us. They make us feel like we're part of a bigger human story. And we're just a small but integrated and important piece of that story, so you don't have to be lonely. You are connected to the bigger human story, whether you're at a party or not. And there are ways you can convince yourself of that simply in your own imagination and creative work. And then you feel it and you're more connected.
So all of that is kind of artsy and creative in its process. The approach to seasonal affective disorder is a little more clinical, as I understand it. And Dr. Nobel mentioned the light box, Dr. Hoffman. And I was going to ask you, does light therapy require some sort of special equipment? Or can you simply go out in the backyard and look up at the sun or the cloudy sky and absorb the necessary light?
So you can, depending again on how many high-quality daylight hours you have where you live, yes, you can go outside, get out in the morning. So for treating seasonal depression, what has been shown to be very effective is to get light in the morning early, if you can, between 7 and 10 a.m. is when it's most effective, because the time of day you experience light will impact your body differently. As I said, bright light in the evening will make it hard to sleep, whereas in the morning, it will help you wake up and it will have this energy and mood boosting effect. So blue light is often painted as the bad light. It's not true in the morning. So we kind of need to remember blue light also has its good sides. So if you have enough natural sunlight outside, go out for a walk, go out with a friend, go with a dog, whatever you need, for maybe 30 minutes to an hour. Now, if you do not have that opportunity or it's too cold, you can invest in what we call a light therapy box. They are, depending on the brand, $100 to $200. So it's a wonderful Christmas present if you have a friend that you think might be suffering from seasonal depression, that you could maybe encourage them to use. The problem with light therapy boxes is that they are not FDA regulated. So it's very important to make sure they do not contain any UVA light. So you need to make sure they stay safe, so no UV, and they have to be really bright. So the magic number to look for is 10,000 lux. Again, use them in the morning. And if you can't get the morning light in, do it around noon. It's not recommended to use light therapy boxes after lunch. Go for a walk any time of day. But again, morning light is your best friend when you want to have the mood boosting effect.
And you have said that the use of light boxes is 80% effective in reversing.
If you suffer from seasonal depression, yes.
Okay. So the other prescription for loneliness is to have a circle of friends that you can count on. And if you know somebody who is lonely, be their friend. Come to them, and notice their, and be company for them. And then get this book, Project Unlonely, Healing Our Crisis of Disconnection, by our guest, Dr. Jeremy Nobel with Harvard University, and Dr. Hannah Hoffman, Assistant Professor of Animal Science at Michigan State University. Thank you both for the hour.
Celebrating 25 years on the air, Charlotte Talks with Mike Collins is a production of 90.7 WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from Mazda of South Charlotte. Our executive producer is Wendy Herkey. The senior producers are Gabe Altieri and Sarah D'Elia. Our engineer is Joby Sprinkle. For more information about Charlotte Talks, to listen to past episodes, or subscribe to the podcast, visit wfae.org/charlottetalks. Additional support for WFAE programming comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at mazdaofsouthcharlotte.com.